It's now my honor to introduce Judge Amol Thapar, a man who very rarely gets it wrong, himself a great intellect. He's known to many of you as the highly good-natured jurist seen for years in the Mayflower Promenade, now before you as a featured speaker. He's brilliant. His opinions and dissents have become must-reads, not just for their writing, but for their reasoning. He unfailingly goes where the law takes him, even jailing nuns if necessary. You can look that up if you don't know the reference. He's a first-generation American. His parents were small business owners, both of them. His father owned a heating and air conditioning business in Michigan, and I'm betting in Michigan it was more heating than air conditioning. And it was the classic small business. The Wikipedia page says that as a young man, Amol Thapar worked in the business and drove the truck. Not one of the trucks, the truck. And his mother sold her own successful business after 9/11 to help veterans. Not just talk, and even not just the right attitude, but action. To my mind, Judge Thapar represents so much of what is right in America, the realization of the American dream. Humble beginnings, hard work, and then ending up on everyone's U.S. Supreme Court shortlist. Well, maybe not everyone's, but... Perhaps most importantly, so often, Judge Thapar goes out of his way to help others, colleagues, certainly, but also younger lawyers and students. I've seen it. When it comes to lifting up others, he's tireless. I admire him greatly for that and for many other things. I'm excited to learn what he has to say this morning. It's a very fitting start to our convention. Judge Thapar.
Dean had one requirement when I give this speech, and that was that I mention his name often. So I've now done it. If you hear me say Dean in the middle of a sentence, it's just achieving the quota. He said, I'll give you one quota. Just mention my name a lot. I also want to thank all the veterans. We couldn't do this without them. It was amazing after 9/11 when my mom went to work with the Army. She was a social worker by trade, and she got the opportunity to work with the Army. And every time I talked to her, she was just amazed by the resilience, the wherewithal, and the leadership that the military shows every day. Less than 1% of our citizens now serve, and yet those are the most important people in this country. So God bless them, and thank you for all they do. Well, it's wonderful to be back here today and see so many friends, old and new. I'm grateful to the Federalist Society for putting on this year's event. Every year, the convention takes an extraordinary amount of effort. But this year surely was the most challenging in so many ways. So I want to start by giving thanks to the staff and the student volunteers who have helped make this convention possible. And don't clap after this one, but Dean, too. This promises to be an extraordinary convention, so I'm sure we will appreciate the planners' efforts more and more over the coming days, especially when I'm done and you can hear from speakers that know what they're talking about. The theme of this convention is great: public and private power, preserving freedom or preventing harm. This topic touches on perennial questions about the role of government and the scope of liberty. In my brief remarks today, and Dean told me to keep them brief, I want to talk about a third factor that preserves a healthy balance between the state and the individual. That's the role of civil society in public life. As the late, great Father Richard John Newhouse noted, civil society is made up of those institutions standing between the individual and his private life and the government. The relationships between the individual, the state, and civil society are always interesting questions, and they're especially timely questions to ask in 2021. They tie right into the theme for this year's convention. So much has happened since we were last together in the flesh, and frankly, much of it can seem dispiriting. The pandemic has upended our lives in so many ways. Tens of thousands of families have lost loved ones. So many small businesses have shuttered, and those still open struggle to find workers. I talk to my dad about it often, who is still a small business owner. Less visible, but no less damaging, have been the invisible scars that the pandemic has inflicted upon so many people. Indeed, it is these costs which very well may be the most lasting and the most drastic. Think of the students who have missed half of their college experience or two-thirds of their law school time because of the pandemic. As many schools moved to online education, we unsurprisingly found that this amplified achievement gaps. For millions of American students, the last 2 years were one large write-off. Many of them will have fallen so far behind that it will be daunting for them to catch up. Young adults haven't had it easy either. So many young Americans have deferred marriage or having children in this time of uncertainty. According to the data from the CDC, births in January of 2021 dropped almost 10% from the previous January, the largest drop in decades. These consequences could reverberate for decades. The pandemic has also put more strain on our shared national fabric. In so many cities across America, crime, homelessness, and drug addiction rates are skyrocketing. In 2020, the United States saw an almost 30% rise in the murder rate, the highest year-to-year increase since the FBI began keeping statistics. In too many communities across this country, opioids continue to exact a devastating toll. 93,000 Americans died of drug overdoses in 2020, nearly 30% more than in the previous year. And for these reasons and many others, many Americans are now despondent about our future. According to one poll, 71% of Americans said they're pessimistic about the country's direction. Think about that. Those are sobering numbers. In a country known for its perennial optimism, close to three-quarters of us now think our children will inherit a country worse off than we did. And in large chunks of the country, such as rural America and the Rust Belt, which I love dearly, life expectancy has actually been going down. The Princeton economists Ann Case and Angus Deaton have attributed this to a historically unprecedented trend and what they labeled deaths of despair, drug abuse, alcoholism, and suicide. And in prior times of crisis, we could at least be confident that whatever we faced it together as Americans. From our world wars and the Great Depression to the Cold War and 9/11, we bonded as Americans when we were worst hit. Leading businessmen, politicians, and other community leaders would work hand in hand. Now, however, social division and polarization seem at all-time highs. And the pandemic has coincided with an uptick in intolerance, popularly dubbed the cancel culture. Its simple name should not obscure its force. What began on a college courtyard has moved into the newsroom and the corporate boardroom with alarming speed. From Hollywood to professional sports and everything in between, it now seems you can lose your job and be shunned if you voice the slightest disagreement with today's fashionable views. Unsurprisingly, social distrust in our public and private institutions is at an all-time high. We have, in short, been far too focused on the pluribus and not enough on the unum. So what can be done? Where should we look? At times like this, when every day's newspaper carries another round of bleak headlines, it's easy to resign ourselves to fatalism. I certainly feel that temptation. But when I come here to the National Lawyers Convention and I think about what the next few days will bring, I cannot help but feel rejuvenated and optimistic. After everything I just said, you must be wondering why. It's because the Federalist Society represents, in its small way, the genius of America. Of course, no institution will single-handedly save America, not even the Federalist Society. I am not naive about the limits of law and judging. As our founders understood, a society is only as good as its people. And our system was designed, as John Adams put it, for a virtuous and religious people. Still, a good legal culture can sustain and safeguard it. That requires judges who don't make things up, judges who begin with the text rather than the preferred policy outcomes, and it's important that judges respect the Constitution as ratified. On these fronts, the Federalist Society has done extraordinary and important work. Long may it continue. Yet the Federalist Society is an antidote for our problems today in a different sense. And that's because of what this organization represents. On one level, yes, it's a group of lawyers who like to nerd out about whether we should incorporate the Bill of Rights through the Due Process Clause or the Privileges or Immunities Clause. But on another level, FedSoc represents a uniquely successful yet also entirely representative example of how grassroots civil society can solve important public policy problems. What do I mean by civil society? It's hard to give it a definition. So I look to Alexis de Tocqueville, one of the great analysts of American Light, to shed some light. In his magisterial Democracy in America, Tocqueville observed that in Europe, the first person you turn to when you see a problem, for example, is the government in France or a great lord in England. But in America, he said, we first turn to our neighbors. Here we find a friend to raise money with for a small cause, or an ally to build a church, a school, or a hospital with. In other words, what stood out to this French nobleman was our small d, democratic approach to problem solving. When faced with problems, we don't wait for an English duke or Paris bureaucrat to show up. We the people acted, not just in how we picked the government, that too was radical, but also in what we solved without government. And Yuval Levin, one of the great successors to Tocqueville, points out that this civil society remains the backbone of our great country. As you might have noted, I still have not given a definition of civil society, but we all know it when we see it. It's the local school board that shapes our values and heritage. It's our churches, synagogues, temples, and mosques that tend to our soul. And it's the Salvation Army which feeds the hungry and houses the homeless. That spirit is all around us. It's what makes our country rich. It's what makes our lives rich. It gives us meaning and it connects us to our neighbors. It teaches us how to practice democratic politics. If we learn by doing, then mass democracy requires a civil society. The day-to-day work of identifying problems, offering diagnoses, and then treatments gives us a stake in our society. And it teaches us how to find common ground with those who may vote for a different party, worship at a different temple, or God forbid, root for someone other than the Kentucky Wildcats. Worse yet, root for Duke. Trust, cooperation, a willingness to hear different perspectives, and civic duty. These are the ingredients of a successful republic. Civil society has long been where Americans cultivated these traits. Edmund Burke understood this when he urged us to cherish our little platoons, the basic units of society. For him, it meant kin and kith, friends, the neighborhood, the town church, and the debate clubs where voters discuss public affairs. As he wrote in Reflections on the Revolution in France, to love the little platoon we belong to in society is the first principle, the germ, as it were, of public affection. It is the first link in the series by which we proceed towards a love to our country and to mankind. But just as importantly, we need civil society because civil society works. The economist Friedrich Hayek famously noted that central planning goes awry when planners lack information about what's happening on the ground. Civil society doesn't have that problem. It forms organically to tackle a local problem, and the people who invest in it have skin in the game. They have the incentives and knowledge, and usually the skills, to understand the problem in its full scope and then solve it. And compared to individuals, civil society is a force multiplier. One voice can be drowned out by the status quo. A chorus in unison is a different matter. Whenever someone's skeptical about what civil society can do, I tell them about a little initiative back in Ohio and Kentucky. I learned about it when I was looking to donate my old car. Two churches, one in northern Kentucky, one in Cincinnati, formed a program known as Wheels. They would take old cars like mine that people were willing to donate. When I was ready to donate it, I took it to the garage, where I found a bunch of wonderful retired mechanics from those churches. First, they prayed with me over my car. Then they promised to put it to good use. They had built a beautiful garage where they turned these old cars, sometimes lemons, into amazing used cars. And they provided those cars to people down on their luck. Perhaps someone recovering from drug addiction, or a single mother trying to get on her feet. The most amazing part, though, was witnessing how one gesture of kindness can generate a self-sustaining cycle of positive change. These cars weren't a one-time cash transfer. Instead, for many of these people, this program was life-altering. For them, the car didn't just represent a stranger's act of generosity at a time when life looked bleak. It was also, I am sure, a ticket to a new life. Many of them likely used their cars to drive to a better paying job or to attend night classes to get an education. And why do I know this? Because so many people would then come back to the program, not to trade up, but to donate their own cars and complete the circle of giving back. The very people who got the cars would later donate their old cars to the program. Clear away the brush and the academic jargon. That's what we mean by civil society. Here was a simple solution to a difficult problem. Retired mechanics? Check. A spare garage? Check. Parishioners who needed to get rid of their aging vehicles? Check. And people who just needed a little help to kickstart their lives again? Check again. No one needed to fill out reams of paperwork. The Department of Transportation didn't need to create a new and improved Churches and Clunkers program. This was just ordinary folks helping their neighbors who were down on their luck. And the most incredible part of it all, in America, the story I told you is entirely ordinary. From Ohio to Oregon, volunteer initiatives like this transform lives every day through extraordinary acts of civic duty. And if you're still not convinced, look around you. That's right, look at the Federalist Society. This right here, this convention, shows us the power of civil society. Think back to the Federalist Society's roots. In the late 1970s and 80s, Yale Law School was a crazy place. Okay, like death and taxes, some things will never change. But the legal landscape was just as bleak across the nation. And so many veterans of this organization know firsthand it was the Wild West in federal courthouses. Though the Warren Court had technically passed, its mode of jurisprudence was very much still alive. The judiciary would routinely find implied causes of action or make rights up out of whole cloth. Consider the field of statutory interpretation for a minute. When the Federalist Society began, people would give you vacant stares if you told them you were an originalist or textualist. Justice Scalia fondly tells a story of him saying it and everyone running from the room. My clerks and the younger students in this crowd may not believe it, but it's true. There was a time not so long ago when people would look at you funny if you thought judges were bound by the text of the law. If you cited a dictionary in statutory interpretation class, your classmates would look at you with disbelief and perhaps some concern. In those days, statutory interpretation was all about legislative intent. If you don't believe me, look at Train versus Colorado Public Interest Research Group. There, the Supreme Court noted that it did not even need to consult the plain meaning of the text and use scare quotes around plain meaning because the legislative history was clear enough and answered the question. The decision was 8-0. It's safe to say things have now changed. As one justice put it, we are all now originalists and textualists. So what prompted this sea change? Well, of course, in part, it was the greatness of Justices Scalia and Thomas, but it was also in no small part because of the efforts of a handful of students in the early 1980s. When the first convention took place in 1982, almost 40 years ago, it gathered students from just a handful of schools. At the time, the Federalist Society's founding fathers did not know they were starting a national movement. Instead, for them, the convention was simply their way of tackling a problem that they saw in their communities, an overwhelming intellectual homogeneity on their campuses. They didn't seek to solve the problems by looking to the government to pass a law. No one sought for the state to impose an intellectual diversity quota on their schools. Instead, they focused on what civil society does best, creating homegrown solutions to local problems. In this case, that meant the cut and thrust of intellectual debate. Don't take my word for it. As Stephen Calabrese put it at the time, FedSoc's original objective was to have some good debates and to force faculty members to confront the ideas by inviting speakers to Yale who brought different views. Imagine that. In an event celebrating the Federalist Society's 25th anniversary, Justice Scalia spoke in characteristically memorable terms. We thought we were just planting a wildflower among the weeds of academic liberalism. It turned out to be an oak. As the next few days will show us, the spirit of robust debate and intellectual vigor remains the beating heart of the Federalist Society's mission. Now, admittedly, the Mayflower Hotel is not quite what you might think of when someone mentions civil society. But all of us know that the Federalist Society is so much more than this convention. The organizers of the convention will be the first to tell you this. Don't get me wrong. I'm as excited for the Scalia dinner tonight as everyone else. But the real success of the Federalist Society can't be measured solely by the number of judges or justices who are members. It can't be measured by the number of well-heeled lawyers in this room or in some of DC's leading firms. It can't even be measured by the public interest lawyering that furthers the goals many of us share. All of this is important and good, and we are grateful to each of you. But the real work of the Federalist Society happens out there. It's where lawyers take time from their busy lives to meet in Northern Kentucky or Miami to discuss the ideas about the rule of law, how to interpret statutes, and yes, what the appropriate division of power between private and public actors should look like. It's the local chapter that puts on events challenging the prevailing orthodoxy of a law school or a legal profession that is still too homogeneous and still too sheltered. It's the minds that have been changed one way or another and the friendships that have been deepened through this relentless pursuit for truth. You can draw a direct line between their daily efforts and the annual convention we host this week. That's why when you meet another Federalist Society member, you know what you're getting. You know you're meeting an intellectual brother or sister who has been sharpened through the same formative training. You know you are meeting someone who takes ideas seriously, who wants to get the law right, and who knows the judge's place is not as a legislature. And you know you're meeting someone who had courage, real courage, to stand apart from the crowd at law school. This week's conference exemplifies all of this. We begin by interrogating the scope of corporate power and what role corporations do and should play in our democratic process. We end by asking how public policy should incorporate scientific research, when, as the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Richard Feynman remarked, science begins with a distrust of experts. Luckily for you and me, I'm not an expert on anything. That's why Dean had me do this versus putting me on one of the panels. But I marvel at the breadth of perspectives we'll see across the 4 days. From antitrust to religious liberty law, the Federalist Society has marshaled experts and amateurs, liberals and conservatives, government officials and regulators, to bring us an intellectual feast, just like it always does every day across our country. And the nation's better off for it. The legal culture is certainly better off for the Federalist Society's efforts. Now, there's still much work to be done, don't get me wrong. If you don't believe me, just read my dissents. Thank you. But the legal culture has certainly changed in seismic ways, thanks to the dedication of many of the people found in the local chapters. So if there's one thing you should take away from this conference, well, maybe two. First, enjoy each other's company. Face-to-face conversation is how we make Republican government work. It's how we solve problems and find the common good. No idea is a sacred cow. Nothing should be off limits. True civility is not mere kindness, though that's important. It's when interlocutors who are deeply divided on something still respect one another by pressing their best arguments. And second, we should take the Federalist Society as an inspiration. At a time when there is still much to be pessimistic about, the Federalist Society reminds us what is great about America. As Tocqueville put it, above all, not what public administration executes, but what is executed without it and outside of it. So I urge you to ask three questions when thinking about public power and private rights in the coming days. One, what problems do you see in your community? Two, How can you solve it? And three, who do you need to help you solve it? In some cases, that does require government. I'm not naive. As I mentioned before, we really need our armed forces to win wars. In fact, we won two world wars with them. And the federal government has played a critical role in setting up highways that connect our great country. But I submit that many problems, more than you might think, are solved through what we Catholics called subsidiarity, a fancy word for the idea that problems should be solved by local groups and associations that are best equipped to tackle them. This is not a new idea, of course, but it is one that should guide us and inspire us. In bleak times like now, we should remember Ronald Reagan's statement, freedom is never more than one generation away. That's right, and it's worth noting that Reagan knew to deliver this line at the annual convention of the Kiwanis International, one of the great pillars of American civil society. And at this convention, when I think what the Federalist Society has achieved over the past four decades and what American civil society has solved since before Tocqueville even arrived on our beautiful shores, I cannot help but think of another quote by the great President Reagan. There is nothing wrong about America that cannot be solved by what is right about America. I hope this convention inspires us to prove him right once more. May God continue to bless you all, and may God continue to bless the greatest country in the world, the United States of America. Thank you.